Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Stephen Couture, and to begin, we chatted about chronic lymphocytic leukemia.
For a large part, FCR had become the major regimen used for initial treatment, certainly for fit patients, someone that you think can tolerate chemoimmunotherapy. But bendamustine and rituximab was certainly becoming increasingly popular, and I think it really sort of developed the reputation that it was a kinder, gentler regimen. And so fortunately, the German CLL study group did the definitive study of FCR versus BR in fit patients, someone that you would consider giving chemoimmunotherapy to, including older patients. Although only about a third of the patients in the trial, a little more than a third, were over 65. And the bottom line is, I think the results make everybody happy. So the primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and FCR was superior. More patients achieved a complete response with FCR, and that translated to a longer progression-free survival, about 55 months versus about 3.5 years with BR, very consistent with what we've seen previously. However, the trade-off was tolerability. So FCR led to a higher incidence of neutropenia as well as thrombocytopenia, and that led to a higher incidence of infections. And interestingly, when you look at this by age group, that was seen primarily in those over 65. So the tolerability issue in the older patients, again, remember, the typical CLL patient, those are the ones who had more infections. And the other interesting point is that difference was not seen during the 6 months that you're giving therapy, but rather in the 6 months immediately after the regimens were completed. So it's something that stays with you for a while.
In terms of the practical use of FCR, you know, people say age is just a number, but, you know, is there an age at which, even if the patient has no comorbidities and is perfectly fit, you sort of start pulling back from FCR?
Well, I think that really speaks to what your goal is in treating a patient. And I think you have to look at that for each individual patient. You can't be dogmatic that, you know, this is the regimen I use in everyone, and this is my second line regimen. So, for example, you know, bendamustine rituximab is a pretty reasonable regimen in terms of efficacy. And so perhaps your 75-year-old patient, even if they're, you know, relatively fit, because after all, you're considering giving them chemoimmunotherapy, maybe BR is a better choice. Sure, your progression-free survival may be shorter, but it's still measured in years, and you will have less risk of a serious infection in that patient. So I think that's a scenario where you might choose that regimen. Now, if you have somebody who's in their mid-50s, late 50s, I think that's a little bit different there. I would use FCR rather than BR, for example.
Now, you mentioned the older age of these patients, and that same German group also had a study in older patients, really with comorbidities, looking at the new anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody, obinutuzumab. Can you talk a little bit first about what the difference is between obinutuzumab and rituximab and what was seen in this study and how it affected your practice?
So obinutuzumab is an anti-CD20 antibody, but it was really specifically designed to be more effective in how these drugs work. It's not a different target, remember, but it has enhanced what we call effector function by how it interacts with the Fc receptor. And so that was the whole premise behind this second-generation antibody. And so in the trial that you reference, they were looking at patients where they said, okay, this is a patient group that is unfit for standard chemoimmunotherapy. What are we going to use? And in the U.S., we recognize the fact that a lot of those patients got single-agent rituximab, even though it's not particularly effective as a single agent. But in most of the rest of the world, patients receive chlorambucil or increasingly chlorambucil plus rituximab. So the relevant part of that trial was really the comparison of obinutuzumab chlorambucil versus rituximab chlorambucil. And again, with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival, the obinutuzumab-chlorambucil combination was superior. I believe it was about 25 months or so versus, I think, around 15 months. No difference in overall survival yet in that trial, but you're getting a better response that lasts a longer period of time. So if you're looking at a patient and you're thinking about giving them a antibody therapy like rituximab, then you might consider using obinutuzumab instead.
Is that what you do in your own practice? In what situations, if any, are you using obinutuzumab?
You know, things are changing with the novel drugs, and so that certainly colors how I approach things. But if we put that aside for a moment, if you have an older patient that you want to get disease control because they're symptomatic, and you really don't feel that they would tolerate even bendamustine and rituximab, then that's a patient I would choose to give obinutuzumab to.
One of the issues with obinutuzumab that people have talked a lot about are the infusion reactions. What I'm hearing is, you know, more severe, very early, but then don't necessarily continue the way the rituximab infusion reactions do. What's your own take on this, and how much of a problem is it?
I think that's an accurate description. I mean, this is not a rituximab infusion reaction. It certainly could be more severe initially, and the dosing schedule reflects that. So you actually start out with a lower dose before you increase, so patients have to tolerate that. So I think you just have to be aware that with that first, even small dose, that there may be an infusion reaction, and it may be of greater severity perhaps than you see with your typical first dose rituximab. But having said that, it really hasn't limited us being able to give the drug effectively, you know, continue patients on it, go to the higher dose later. It's just something that if you're starting to use it for the first time, you and particularly your infusion staff needs to be aware of. It's not just another rituximab.
So I'm sorry, but I don't know the exact chronology, but did you and Jeff Sharman work together?
Jeff was one of my fellows.
Okay, great, because I work with him recently, and he's the first person that I've heard talking about obinutuzumab alone as a single agent. Is that something you ever think about or do?
That's what I always do.
Really? And there you're the second person.
The reason is because, you know, you have to realize clinical trials are done for one of two reasons. Hopefully, both reasons are the same. And that is, they're done because at the end of the day, the result is going to show a benefit, and clinicians will say, wow, that really makes sense. I'm going to do that. I'm going to use that. Or they're done to get a drug approved. And hopefully, like I say, the two are the same. But you might say, well, why did they combine it with chlorambucil? And it's because the standard of care had evolved from chlorambucil alone to chlorambucil plus rituximab. So if you're going to compare it to that regimen, then you're going to use obinutuzumab plus chlorambucil. Do I believe that chlorambucil adds anything to that? No. So if I'm going to choose to use that drug, I'm going to use it as a single agent.
You know, there was actually a paper at ASH that struck my attention in that regard, looking at the patients who initially got randomized to chlorambucil alone in the German trial, then had disease progression, and then they added in obinutuzumab, and it looked like they saw a lot of activity. And to me, it sort of supports this idea of single-agent activity, because if you assume they were not responding to chlorambucil, then maybe most of the benefit was from the obinutuzumab. So, for example, you have an older patient that you just want to shy away from chemotherapy in general, you're saying you more likely would just use the obinutuzumab by itself.
I always do, yeah. And remember, in the U.S., single-agent rituximab in that patient population is quite common. So for an oncologist saying, hey, that's the drug I would have used, and now we have this newer drug that may be a bit better, let me go ahead and use that instead.
What about combining it with other agents, particularly bendamustine? What data do we have right now? Is that something you ever do in your practice?
No, I never do it. And to be perfectly honest, that's not where the field is going. It is because of the new oral agents, those kinds of combinations are going to become moot. So in CLL, at least, we're not going to say, gee, what's FCO versus FCR, or what's BO versus BR? 5 years ago, that would be very relevant, but no longer.
So maybe along the same lines of maybe it's not really relevant or about to become irrelevant, but still I'm curious, has been the question of maintenance therapy, anti-CD20 therapy in CLL. And we saw a couple of papers again at the last ASH meeting, one with rituximab and the other with ofatumumab. Again, what are your thoughts about right now at this moment using anti-CD20 maintenance in CLL?
Absolutely not. I think it's irrelevant. You know, it's nice that those trials were eventually done, but I view them now as historic relics.
So let's talk about the new agents, what we know about them. Mainly, we'll start out with CLL. If you can talk about what we have observed, both in terms of efficacy and tolerability, not just with ibrutinib and adalimumab, but also with venetoclax, ABT-199 formerly.
So ibrutinib targets Bruton's tyrosine kinase, and you see tremendous activity. Essentially, all patients respond to it when you initially treat them. And that includes your patients that often don't respond to our standard drugs, like those with the 17p deletion, certainly those who have become fludarabine refractory, for example. It's great to know that you can tell your patient that you're going to give them this once-a-day pill, and they're going to respond. What do you see? You see the lymph nodes shrink dramatically in a matter of days, not weeks, not months. And at the same time, you see a lymphocytosis. The lymphocyte count goes up because it's releasing the lymphocytes, the CLL cells, from the lymph nodes. But fortunately, that doesn't cause any clinical problems in CLL. But you need to make your patients aware of it, because I don't know about your patients, but my patients religiously follow their numbers. So that's what's going to happen. And in general, it's quite well tolerated. You can see some easy bruising. It seems to inhibit platelet function. Maybe a little bit of diarrhea, some loose stools when you first start out. That can be controlled with Imodium if need be, but that goes away. So in general, very well tolerated. We have patients now who've been on that drug continuously for 5 years from the very original trials. And as we've followed patients and as we've reported, the safety continues to look quite good. There's no new late side effects, there's no cumulative side effects, and the efficacy persists. So even from the original trial, which was heavily pretreated patients, the median progression-free survival hasn't been reached for the group as a whole. And for the small group of patients, 31 patients over 65, where we used it as initial therapy, there's only one patient who's progressed. They progressed very early at 8 months. No other patient has progressed to date. So that's looking quite promising. And as a result, it is approved for CLL or SLL patients who have received at least one prior therapy. And it also has an upfront indication in this country for patients with the 17p deletion.
Regulatory issues aside, would you like to give ibrutinib upfront in patients, you know, without 17p?
Absolutely. And fortunately, we've completed a study that will address that issue. So this is a randomized study, treatment naive, age 65 and above, chlorambucil versus ibrutinib.
I guess the one thing I've heard about is the fact that by using chemoimmunotherapy, FCR, BR, you have the likelihood of putting the patient into a remission that doesn't require treatment, as opposed to ibrutinib requiring continuous indefinite treatment, particularly the costs and also the toxicities associated with that. Any thoughts about that argument?
Fortunately, it is well tolerated, so the toxicity issues, I think, are modest at best. And of course, if you are going to take a drug continuously, it has to have that kind of profile. But it's a point well taken, and I think it really depends on a patient. If you say, look, I can give you 6 months of this chemotherapy, and here's the risks associated with it, but the expectation is that you're likely to respond, and that response is going to last on average, you know, 3.5, 4, 5 years, depending on the regimen. Or I can give you this once-a-day pill, better tolerated than any chemoimmunotherapy, but you have to take it continuously. The cost issue, let's be realistic about it. We're not talking about, in this country, the impact on our healthcare system, unfortunately. What matters to a patient is what it costs them. So if their insurer covers the drug, they really get it at little to no cost, essentially, despite how expensive it is.
You mentioned the bleeding. Can you talk about your own clinical experience with that? What's the spectrum of what you've observed in terms of bleeding? And how do you deal with patients who are going to need surgery or dental procedures?
So it seems like it inhibits platelet function, so an aspirin-like effect, if you will. So bruising, particularly for older patients on their forearms, is quite common. So you just have to let your patients know that this is likely to occur. Also, you know, encourage them from not using aspirin unless it's, you know, medically necessary, etc. Serious spontaneous bleeding, I think, is quite uncommon. The randomized trials have shown us that. Very early on in the trials, it was a patient who had a subdural hematoma who was also on warfarin. So for most of the duration of the rest of the trials, warfarin was prohibited, although other oral anticoagulants were not. I've had a patient who experienced a subdural hematoma on ibrutinib, but it was an older man who had a very nice response, but was hospitalized because of facial zoster and got dehydrated. And after he was discharged, while he was rehabbing, he had fallen a few times, and several months later, he showed up. So, you know, that's kind of what you might see in somebody who's on Coumadin in that situation. So, you know, we recognize what the issue is, but when you look at the data we have so far, like the RESONATE trial that compared it to ofatumumab, there's no difference in serious bleeding episodes between the two arms, and the absolute number was quite small.
What do you do with patients who need surgery?
So I would view it like aspirin. So the general guidelines for a major procedure would be to hold the drug for a week ahead of time and a week after. For something minor or where local bleeding isn't going to be problematic, 3 days is the general recommendation.
And what about the patient who comes in on an anticoagulant? What do you do? And does it matter which anticoagulant?
Well, as I mentioned, we weren't allowed to use warfarin for most patients in the trials, but we were allowed to use the other oral anticoagulants. And as a hematologist, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that those would be any better, but that's how the trials were done. This isn't a drug-drug interaction with warfarin, for example. It's just recognizing that it is an anticoagulant. So I don't think it should preclude the use of ibrutinib if somebody is on an oral anticoagulant. Personally, I like to use the other agents anyway, so I have no trouble switching patients over if I need to. But I think as we get greater experience, it wouldn't surprise me if the recommendation about specifically avoiding warfarin goes away as well.
What about atrial fibrillation? What's been seen in the trials and what's your own clinical experience?
So that was a surprise, and it really came out in the RESONATE trial because that was the first randomized trial. So there, I think it was 11 patients who had AFib versus one, I think, in the ofatumumab arm. But it was generally a very brief duration, a matter of days. There were some risk factors, older patients, over 70, I think, those with a prior history of AFib, like paroxysmal AFib, those who had concurrent, say, pulmonary infection, perhaps provoking it. So it didn't lead to drug discontinuation in, I think, all except one patient. It's been seen also in the RESONATE-2 trial, the 17P deleted trial, pretty much a similar incidence. There, I think it was about 8%, but no drug discontinuation. So I think it's real. It's pretty interesting. And of course, we need to understand it better. But right now, I would say it shouldn't preclude you from choosing ibrutinib in a patient with even chronic atrial fibrillation if you feel it's the best drug to treat their CLL.
What do you do in the patient with no history of atrial fibrillation who develops it on ibrutinib?
Well, I think there, you know, like most scenarios in medicine, you're making a clinical judgment. How important is ibrutinib for that patient? What are your other choices to treat them at that point in time? And so, you know, what's your motivation for trying to continue the drug despite that event? Because that patient, of course, is going to end up on an anticoagulant and whether or not they cardiovert. But if you do have other choices or if the disease is very well controlled at that time, you might elect to stop the therapy and see what happens or change their therapy. So I think that's really an individual patient decision based on the specific circumstances.
Let's talk a little bit about alpelisib. Again, if you can talk about the mechanism of action and then specifically in CLL, what we know about efficacy and tolerability.
So alpelisib is also an oral small molecule inhibitor, and it is also a B-cell receptor signaling pathway inhibitor, but its target is the PI3 kinase, specifically the delta isoform. There are other isoforms, and there have been other PI3 kinase inhibitors previously, but a lot of the toxicity that was seen with those drugs was due to inhibiting other isoforms. So this is the first pure delta inhibitor, and that's particularly relevant in lymphoid malignancies like CLL. So also a very effective drug, our early trials, single agent, Idela. I couldn't tell you that efficacy is any different between ibrutinib and alpelisib. And the pattern of response is exactly the same. Rapid shrinkage of lymph nodes, the lymphocytosis, which resolves over time. However, the safety issues are different. So you don't have the bleeding issue, you don't have the atrial fibrillation issue, but many patients, perhaps up to 20% early on, usually 4, 8, 10 weeks, you might see an asymptomatic transaminitis. So you stop the drug, it resolves, usually within a couple of weeks. You restart the drug, often even without dose reduction, and you never see it again. So it's not your typical hepatotoxicity that you see with some drugs, that if you continue to use it, it continues. So that doesn't bother me that much. You just learn to recognize it and deal with it. But I think what we're increasingly seeing as patients stay on the drug is a diarrheal illness, which is really a microscopic colitis. So these patients, and the median time to onset is about 9 months. You could see it later, 2 years, 3 years. And it appears as a profuse watery diarrhea. Not bloody diarrhea, not fever, often not even a lot of cramps. And if you do colonoscopy, the mucosa usually doesn't look all that bad, but when you biopsy it, it has all the characteristics of an inflammatory condition, a colitis. So we've learned to treat it with steroids, and generally the non-absorbable steroids like budesonide, which is quite effective. And in some patients, we're able to restart the drug. Others, we can't. And even in those where we can restart, sometimes we'll see recurrences. So it's become clear to me, at least, that this is really what is going to limit our ability to treat patients continuously with this effective drug. And so we have to figure out more time-limited approaches to using alpelisib. So that's going to be the real challenge.
In what situations in CLL do you use alpelisib? And it's approved with rituximab for CLL, but yet an indolent lymphoma approved by itself. Is that just sort of a factor of the way the trials are done, or is there something biologic about that?
That's exactly right. It's a factor of how the trials were designed in the two disease states, because in CLL, the major trial that got it approved was for unfit patients, someone you're not going to give chemoimmunotherapy to, relapsed refractory disease. It was a randomization. Every patient got rituximab. And then in a double-blinded, placebo-controlled manner, patients either got Idela or placebo. And there was a crossover allowed if there was progression. So that way, patients could receive alpelisib if they needed it, even if they had been on the placebo arm early on. And at the first safety analysis, the trial was stopped because there was such a dramatic difference in responses and progression-free survival and even overall survival at a very early time point. So that's why it was approved in combination with rituximab. Personally, I'm very comfortable using it as a single agent based on our extensive experience in the early trials.
Right now, outside of a trial setting, how do you incorporate both alpelisib as well as ibrutinib into your management?
Well, for the most part, for patients who've been previously treated, if they need treatment again, I'll choose to use these agents. I'm not going to give somebody BR who, say, had FCR with their first course. I'm not going to repeat one of those regimens, for example. I don't see any reason why a patient shouldn't receive one of these drugs as second-line therapy, for example. And right now, I tend to use ibrutinib simply because of the colitis issue. I'm sure there's exceptions in very specific patients, but in general, that's sort of my algorithm.
And alpelisib in the patient who progresses on ibrutinib?
We have limited experience, but you definitely see those patients respond and vice versa. So that's very nice that we have two very effective drugs that we can use if there's a problem with one of them.
So how about venetoclax? Again, what's the mechanism and what do we know about it in CLL?
So venetoclax, or ABT-199, is also an oral drug, and it is a very specific inhibitor of BCL-2. So BCL-2 is not part of the B-cell receptor signaling pathway, but we've long known that it's highly overexpressed in CLL and is responsible for really impairing apoptosis and also conferring resistance to a lot of our standard drugs that we use as well. And so a lot of rationale for targeting BCL-2, and in the trials we've seen its efficacy has been quite good. So the initial trial was your typical dose escalation trial, heavily pretreated patients, fludarabine refractory, 17p deleted, the usual patients that you might see who have exhausted most other therapies, and you saw extremely high response rates, including, you know, up to 20% complete responses in this kind of patient group. That was quite impressive. But what was also seen was tumor lysis. So two patients actually died presenting with acute renal failure because this issue wasn't recognized. So the trials were kind of halted and redesigned, and the design was a stepwise dose escalation. So the target dose was 400 milligrams. So these patients started at 20, then 50, 100, 200. It's a once daily drug, and the stepwise dose escalation was done on a weekly basis. Initially, we hospitalized all patients for several days, very careful monitoring of their electrolytes, tumor lysis issues. And what we've learned, fortunately, is that dosing schedule works. You don't see clinical tumor lysis. So we've gone on. We've completed a trial for relapsed 17p deleted patients. We have an ongoing trial for patients who have previously received idela or ibrutinib, so yet another option. So I think this is going to be a drug that will likely eventually get approved. It'll give us another great option, and it's different than the other two. So what you see with this drug is actual clearance of the bone marrow as well. You don't tend to see that with the other two drugs, at least not in the short term, not even up to a year or longer. So now you can start to ask questions like, can we stop these therapies? Can we use it in a time-limited manner? For example, there's a trial the German CLL study group is doing of obinutuzumab with venetoclax. So, you know, let's use an effective anti-CD20 antibody. Is that going to add value? And can we get patients into a complete response and actually stop therapy?
So I'm actually thinking maybe we should go from most encouraging to least encouraging here. And so I'll just bring in APL and ask you to comment on what's new that you think a general oncologist should know about. And of course, the issue of whether or not, you know, atra-arsenic can be utilized with that chemotherapy and in which patients.
So APL is a great disease. And I've been fortunate because I've been involved in the trials that led to the approval of all transretinoic acid, ATRA, and also the trial that allowed the approval of arsenic in the U.S. So, you know, this is a disease, this is a subtype of acute myeloid leukemia that was the most feared disease because of the bleeding complications, the DIC you get. This is the one that was more difficult to treat. And look at what's happened over the last 15 years. It's gone from the most feared to the least feared. And it's because of clinical trials, just a beautiful series of clinical trials done around the world showing us how we can cure this disease. So remember now, we divide patients into two groups. The lower risk group, simply a white count less than 10,000. And remember, in general, APL often presents with a low count, not a high count, even pancytopenia, right? Greater than 10,000, high risk, okay? So in the last couple of years, we have this trial from Italy where patients with low-risk APL were randomized to receive oral ATRA and standard infusional arsenic trioxide. No chemo, traditional chemotherapy versus ATRA plus a traditional chemotherapy regimen. And essentially, everybody responded, and with vanishingly few relapses. So this is even better than treating Hodgkin's disease in adults or pediatric ALL. And the trial we want to do next, and it'll be the trial that ends all trials, would be oral arsenic along with ATRA. So wouldn't it be great to treat an acute leukemia with two oral therapies? So for me, if I have a low-risk patient, my treatment of choice is oral ATRA and arsenic. Avoid anthracyclines. Now, we still have a problem in the higher-risk patients, and that major problem, not just relapse, but early death due to bleeding. And despite the introduction of all these more effective agents, that's still a challenge. So it really warrants a very aggressive blood product replacement, early recognition of the disease. If you suspect APL, give ATRA. There's no downside if you're wrong. It's like if you have chest pain, give aspirin. It's the same approach you should take for this acute leukemia. And then, you know, get confirmation. And if it's not APL, that's fine. Stop the ATRA. But we've done trials where we've added this antibody therapy, gemtuzumab, to the treatment, and we'll have those results. So that's still an area where we need some novel approaches to improve things further.
You know, this issue of early deaths and the early use of ATRA, we've talked about that for years. What's the scope of the existing problem? Do you still see patients who are dying? And I just recently became aware of the fact that a lot of hospitals don't carry ATRA, and you can't actually get it.
That's absolutely true, and that is the problem. And it's understandable because it's a rare disease. And so, you know, you're probably more likely to outdate the small supply you have rather than use it. But the message we try to get out there to the community is, you know, if you suspect this at all, don't wait. And if you don't have ATRA, get the patient transferred as soon as possible to a center. I mean, you know, to be honest, this is a disease that really should be treated at a specialized center, at least for the induction therapy. It's just not seen enough. And the stakes are so high because you know you can cure the majority of patients. And despite all of our efforts, the bleeding issue is still a problem in high-risk patients. So we have to aggressively replete fibrinogen, platelets, keep those thresholds much higher while you're initiating therapy in the higher-risk patients.
Let's finish out talking about ALL. And first, are there any situations that you can see it's justifiable for a general oncologist to manage these patients, or should all these people be going to a tertiary center?
Well, I think they really should go to a tertiary center. And I think my colleagues who are out there in the trenches would probably agree, because it's a lot of work for those patients. And, you know, if you have primarily an office-based practice, it's really a tremendous amount of effort and a commitment to manage those patients. You know, unless you have a local setup or a large group where you have the infrastructure and the help to deal with that. And then remember, those regimens go on and on. Those are usually 8 months of intensive therapy and then another couple years of maintenance. But the initial treatment, I think you'd do much better if those patients can be treated at a referral center. And I think that's becoming increasingly important because finally, we're getting new effective drugs for ALL. First of these, of course, is blinatumomab, which is a so-called BiTE, a bispecific T-cell engager. So think of an antibody. One arm recognizes your target and the other engages and tries to activate a T-cell response. Simple concept, and it works in this case. So this is the first. In ALL, the drug is approved for relapsed disease. It has to be given continuously via an infusion pump. There are some potential neurologic side effects. So this is not a therapy to be taken lightly. And if you are going to use it yourself locally, you really want to have somebody who can help you along the way and advise you if problems arise. So it's not just something you give and everything goes well. We have a national trial now asking the relevant question of whether adding blinatumomab to standard chemotherapy after remission is achieved will lead to a decrease in relapse. Because remember, with ALL, the challenge is not so much getting a patient into remission, it's really preventing relapse.